This is Lori Prox with Dr. Kathleen Todd of the Valdez Medical Clinic, also Providence Valdez Medical Center. Kathy, thanks for joining us once again. Mal, we have a lot to talk about here today. Some council meetings discussing the issue of COVID, and it's more dire than I think the general public is aware of after, and even myself, I can just say that personally, because I don't think we had access to this information and data about what's going on with COVID in our hospitals until just very recently. So let's start there. Not everyone, you know, listens to the council meetings. There was one last night, and the topic was whether to have a disaster declaration to then be able to have a mask mandate here in town. So let's set that aside for a moment, though, and explain what's happening at our hospital here. From what I heard last night, Kathy, very stretched, very overwhelmed, and a lot of concern, and also, holy cow, a lot of dedicated employees and doctors just working their tails off. So can you provide us a quick glimpse into what it's like at the hospital and at the clinics and hospital offices around town?
Right. Well, so the total number of COVID cases is way higher than it ever was in the spring. You know, way back at the very beginning when we closed the whole town down, we were ready for a tidal wave. We had some, you know, we had cots set up in the high school, all that sort of stuff. And it turned out, thank goodness, that it never got that bad. Well, what's happened in the meantime, and then it got even better. You know, there was a little blurb in the, I'll say little now, blurb in the spring, but it was kind of contained. You could tell, oh, these people caught it from each other at Alyeska, these people caught it from each other heli skiing or the basketball team coming back or whatever. But you could kind of see it, and it went back down, and we said, okay, great. Some people were worried about the tourists coming in the summer, or the fish processors, although the fish processors kind of were there on their own little island over there that we never even saw them. And, but then it started to rise July 4th. And it's been, it now in Alaska is much, much higher than it ever was before. And why is that? Even though there's vaccinations, because Delta variant is much, much more contagious than the old one, like two or three times as much as contagious. So that what that means is that those people have two or three times as many viruses in the in what they cough out, breathe out, talk out, and so you're that much more likely to catch it. Vaccines still work; they still keep people from getting super sick usually, but they don't keep people from getting it. So we have some breakthrough cases, and we have a lot of people still unvaccinated that are getting cases. The numbers we were worrying about back then, remember, were, oh, gosh, we got up to 20 cases in town or 25 or something. We are at, we've hit 70.
Yeah. I actually have the stats here, and we're going to publish this in our e-news with a history of what the numbers are. And unfortunately, like here at the radio station, we weren't aware of these numbers as they started to get bigger, you know, until they got quite big. So we're going to go back on the history, but just to give you recent history, on the 20th of September, 56 cases, and this is total active cases in Valdez. So that includes residents and non-residents. But there's, you know, then we got up to 71 cases on the 22nd of September, 77 cases on the 24th, and that was 69 active resident cases, and then 7 of those were non-resident, and then the 27th, 62 total cases, and then back into the 50s on this last update. But I want to let people know how that's being updated, because it took me a while to kind of to figure that out. The city of Valdez, when they stood down the Valdez Unified Command, they were charged with putting out a lot of the information regarding COVID. So, you know, when it seemed like it had all died down at the end of summer, or I think you said in May, actually, the medical community was then charged with, I don't know what, but
doing maintenance. That is, you know, incident command structure was really invented for things like earthquakes or forest fire rips through your community or something. It's really meant for kind of short events. That's what it's designed to do. And so at some point, if we had an earthquake, we'd say, okay, well, you know, the sewers and the water is hooked back up, and we can drive down the streets a little bit at least. Now we're going to give it back to the highway department and to FEMA for, you know, reconstructing these houses. We don't really, it's not really an emergency anymore. It's cleaning up after the disaster. And the thing is that right now, in my opinion, we have another disaster bigger than the first, but it came on, it didn't come on us like a tidal wave or an earthquake. It came on us slowly. I like to say this is like the tides coming in, and the tide will go back out again, but tides take longer than tsunamis. And, you know, you're holding your nose above the water, and now you're bouncing to get a breath, and the tide's still coming in. And so we who are dealing with this are hoping that the tide doesn't come in any farther, or that we can, as a community, keep the tide from getting layers on top of layers of water, so that we can still bounce off the bottom, catch a breath, and go back down. And we're not going to be able to do that if we can't, keep the water from coming in again. So it becomes, you know, we were ready for the tidal wave, and it was just a trickle on our feet in comparison to this.
Yeah, and I mean, to oversimplify, in terms of understanding what's going on and knowing, Swan then became charged with getting information out, and then that kind of fell to Dr. Angela Alfaro. And if people heard the meeting the other night, she's got a lot on her plate. I think all the doctors do. And so I think after this last meeting that there will be folks looking into, hopefully, where does this information, you know, who's going to gather this, and how do we get that out? But and to that end, you know, we thought, how do we do this? Well, let's get Dr. Kathy Todd back on here, because I really think, thank you for your time. But I think when we went through this before, I think hearing a real live person talking about their experiences is the best way to share information. And I know there was a lot of information shared last night. Pauline Doucette said that the hospital has lost, and this is the idea of where it is hard, the medical community, you know, they're trying to do their job of taking care of patients. So, trying to let the community know is that's another thing to do. But they have lost 50% of their Valdez acute staff over the last, I don't remember the time period, but, that's huge. And there is great concern, about the ability to take care of patients here in Valdez. So I wanted to see if you could, because you guys are taking on your regular jobs, right? We've said COVID's always in addition to this, but you're doing testing, vaccinations still.
Testing and vaccinations. And the thing I'd like to say about the medical care is that somebody may have followed that Governor Dunleavy has put out a directive saying that all the hospitals in Alaska are on disaster level of care. That is, if you had the earthquake and you've got 30 people coming in with broken this's and that's from their house falling on them, everybody expects that you're not going to get seen very fast. And maybe there's no way to transport people to the orthopedist in Anchorage because the airplanes are broken or the runways are broken. We're actually working on that level of care now. And Valdez had already declared that before the governor did, that there may not be the usual level of care provided, partially because we don't have enough nurses or they're busy with COVID patients, mainly because, well, that is true. But in addition to that, usually what you want to do if you're a small hospital like us and say, oh, this person is in high risk of needing a ventilator. This person's in high risk of needing a specialist. They don't need one right now. But for instance, I sent somebody with bilateral strokes and brain swelling that any minute could have pushed their brain down into their spinal cord and they would have needed a neurosurgeon right now. And you need to send that patient before that happens, not after it happens. You don't have the 4 hours that a perfect transport takes. And right now, we are keeping patients here who need to be in Anchorage where if something goes south, they can be right there and be ready to be intubated or whatever. We are forced to keep them here because Anchorage doesn't have any place to put them. And we have already had people that, you know, we would usually send to Anchorage the day before, and our nurses are stressed to take care of them. We're running out of oxygen. We can only generate so much here at a time. But mainly this patient is getting worse and worse, and basically they have a state transfer center, and they decide that our patient is that much sicker than the patient from Homer, Bethel, Barrow, I don't know where all. And so, yes, they deserve to go to someplace bigger. And one of those places was Juneau, that we would send the patient to Juneau. But the patient finally got a bed, but they were doing CPR on them all the way, or equivalent, CPR on them all the way to Anchorage on the plane. And if they could have gotten out because Anchorage wasn't so busy, they could have maybe not needed the CPR, but for sure not been doing it on the plane. That's not the optimal way to do things. You want to send them before that happens. So it's a double whammy. It's that the patient can't be sent, and then it's also that then we who are so short on nurses can't do it very well here. And it's asking us to do things that we're not really set up to do for long periods of time. We have enough oxygen to do that for one or two patients until the weather clears, but we have to do it longer. I had a patient a few days ago who was vaccinated, but who has immunocompromising drugs that he has to take. And so he got a bad case anyway. And it was too, remember that day it was so windy? Well, he wasn't leaving here anyway. So I didn't even bother to call Anchorage to try to get him a bed because I knew that they weren't going to take him. I knew that I couldn't send him, so I didn't want to bother them. Well, by the next day when the wind died down, he was looking good enough that they wouldn't take him because he's not as sick as everybody else that they're having to see. And so he's kind of on the bottom of the list. And we were able to send him home with oxygen, but he's back in the hospital now, much, you know, worse, waiting for a bed.
Well, and they explained that last night that in addition to, you know, the stresses of all this, that it takes a lot of time to try to transport a patient, and then you're making calls and you're, you know, making pleas to get into a hospital. And I think people like to think things in black and white, like it's either this or it's this. And so I know people have said, well, is it, you know, we can't send anybody out, period. We all the beds are full or they're not full. It's a moving, it's malleable. That's changing every day, depending on who is in the hospital, what the situations are in Anchorage. And I think even Fairbanks, you're any hospital that is able to take, right? So that's a movable thing, but you are really close to the limit.
Well, we're past now. The limit. That is, you know, that it's wonderful to have a transfer center so that you can just call one place and not have to plead with the Providence ER and the Providence pulmonology people and the Alaska Regional people and the Native Hospital and Fort Rich and Matsu and what about Seattle? This is all one call does it all. However, they are saying, yes, we agree your patient needs to go someplace, but they're about the 20th most sick person. And so they're in line, but they're number 20. And so, you know, it could be that Anchorage gets a bunch of openings and they take 18 off the list and your patient's now number two. Or it could be that five more people who are sicker than your patient get onto the list and they push your patient down to number 25. That's the level of care at the moment. And the interesting thing about a lot of this, people vaccinated and not vaccinated or whatever, is that people think of it as affecting them or maybe their family. But my patient with the stroke had nothing to do with COVID. And they didn't get to go as soon as they should have. This was several weeks ago, so it wasn't too bad. They didn't get to go as soon as they should have, and they went to the Providence ER. They were seen in the ER for, I think, a day and a half because they were full. Everything was having to be used for the people with COVID. People who have decided to not take all the measures to try to prevent getting more cases of COVID are affecting people, other people that aren't vaccinated, other people that are vaccinated. They're affecting those people with their broken leg or their stroke or their heart attack or their renal failure or there's something that doesn't relate to COVID at all.
Now, Kathy, do you have any ideas of here locally, vaccinated versus unvaccinated? You know, what are you seeing there in terms of the severity of COVID? Or
well, there are certainly people who have had fairly severe cases, even though they were vaccinated. Some of those, it's because we know their vaccine was less likely to work as well because they were on cancer chemotherapy or organ transplant chemotherapy or something where we have to suppress their immune system on purpose. Thank goodness we haven't any kids yet, but this new Delta variant does hit kids. We used to say, oh, Alpha hardly ever hits kids. That's not true anymore with the new variant. But there's some people whose immunity is not as good.
But of the folks who don't have
those pre-existing vaccines didn't work. The people whose vaccines did work or had no reason to, it basically almost all those people of the positives that I had Monday, out of six people, there were two that had been vaccinated, and they said, oh, okay, I guess this runny nose is a, I kind of felt bad 3 days ago, but I'm already better. That's what we're getting the most with the vaccinated people, whereas there are more people with feeling like they've been run over by a truck and coughing their head off to the point that they have low oxygen among the unvaccinated.
And Kathy, you mentioned that this, the hospital situation is not, I mean, it's dire right now, and everyone's main concern is COVID, but that this situation could potentially put the Valdez hospital at risk. We're already 50% of the Valdez acute staff is gone. Very, very big concern over losing staff and employees. So, and that could jeopardize a rural hospital, right?
Right. One of the council members last night said, well, can't we just hire some more nurses? Why don't we just hire some more nurses? Well, right at this moment, there are none to be had. Every place that's having COVID outbreaks all need more nurses. And we already were kind of at a crisis mode because there's kind of a generation gap there where we're training up new nurses, but people are retiring at the same time. So that is already a problem. But Providence System in Alaska has had twice as many retirements this last year as it usually has. And partly that's people who are just tired or discouraged, or they can't take the emotional impact of seeing somebody who's 25 die who didn't need to. I was told that of the people that have recently quit, five of them for sure, is it because they just don't want to do that much overtime anymore here. And of course, every time somebody quits, then the rest of people have to do more overtime. So you're at more risk to lose those people. We need a very special kind of nurse in Valdez that knows how to do a little bit of everything. A family practice nurse, so to speak, as opposed to an orthopedist and an obstetrician and we have family practice doctors. And that doesn't exist in nursing anymore. There's no school to go, there's no residency program for nurses to go become a rural nurse. And so we get people out of nursing school and we need mentors who will tell them, I know you've been told that unless you train for being an ER nurse for 5 years, you really aren't one. we need mentors to say, yep, you can do OB and then med-surg and then long-term care and then ER. You can do it. You can't do everything like they can in a big city, but you can do what needs to be done here so we can send people out. And if we lose those top, not top, the senior people, I should say, if we lose those senior people who know how to do that, we won't have anybody to instruct the next generation coming up. And we run the possibility of not being able to do colonoscopies and deliveries and surgery and more ER than just saying, yep, it's broken, let's send it to Anchorage. We have an amazing hospital here for our size. We're, you know, nationally known for that, for our size town. And we run the risk of losing that and becoming more like, you know, Glen Allen or Cordova if we wear out all of our experienced nurses.
All right. Well, this has been great insight into the hospital. Kathy, I'm wondering if we can do another segment. We really didn't even get into testing and vaccinations and how that's working in Valdez. Could we do a separate segment to provide that information to people, and we'll run that on Thursday?
I would love to, because it's different than what people expect because of lots of different circumstances, and I would love to fill the public in as to what you can do to help us make the best of the resources that we have.
All right. We'll end this segment, but we will air the testing segment. So tune in for that Thursday. We can find it at kvakradio.com on our podcast page. You can listen to any of these interviews.